we welcome back our friend writer Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
How's it going, Kimball?
Well, I'm battling, and I'm following your Zulu warrior lead when you've been down and up before. I'm dealing with some kidney stones, so trying to play through those.
You're a kidney stone veteran, aren't you?
I am. I've had them before, but they're as the kids say, they are presenting differently this time. In the past, it's been boom, I'm in pain, I'm screaming, bing, they're gone. Now it's been about almost a week of, okay, something's not right. Why aren't these things coming out?
Just tap the area with a hammer.
I've tried that. My son has attempted to squeeze me a few times. I'm following the Fleming rules. I'm pumping the cranberry juice and gallons of water every day.
Okay, I care about the heart. I didn't even know that those were things for your condition. So I'll file that away. Is that true? Is that what cranberry juice?
That's what they say. Yeah, absolutely.
I offered some rabbit punches to the kidney to help out, but he didn't seem to think that'd be a great idea.
Are you drinking like the, the Ocean Spray, or are you drinking the real stuff from the box?
Oh, the real stuff. The real, the pure, the unadulterated, yes.
Well, if it's from Trader Joe's and that's not helping you, that's like the juice version of Liquid Plumber, so I don't know what to tell you, man. Do some more push-ups. Are you still doing the push-ups?
I'm doing them, but they scare me a bit with the stones, but maybe that's what I want. I need something. I know it's going to hurt. I'm going to yell a lot. But I want them gone. So yes, I may start doing some sit-ups too. Working some crunches just to be sure.
Well, I believe in you, Kimball.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I knew I could count on you because if there's a guy who's ready and willing to play through pain, it's you.
Oh yeah, who is that guy with the broken leg for the Maple Leafs? And he's like, "Fear not, fellas. I'm going to pot the Stanley Cup winner." I'd be like, "No, you're not. I have two broken legs, and that game winner is mine, sir."
Goodness. Well, we are going to talk today about the final few chapters in your wonderful book, If You, brackets, Fabula, Fantasy, Effery, Hope. And we've talked about all the stories in here. They're all so great. They are, as we've mentioned before, I'm hesitant to call it a short story collection because it's so much more than that.
The type of thing that makes people tread lightly with the label, doesn't it? Because I don't want to fault anyone, but I don't even really know what to call it with the pre-existing terms. Because we've spoken about this, but I think you want to have a book, and each book is going to be its own cohesive statement, and that statement can be comprised of myriad other statements, but it's going to have an organic unity to it, whether that unity is divvied up, as it were, with chapters in a novel or with stories and what usually people would call a collection. But that label just doesn't, it's never sat right with me. It's not what I want to do. It's not what I believe you do if you're any good. And normally, just what it means is, hey, these were by me. They were what I could manage to write. I got to a certain word count with each of them. It was enough to make a book. I stuck them together, and that's certainly not what this is. The stories are distinct. They can stand alone, but they work in like an ecosystem the way your buddy the clownfish and the sea anemone do. There are themes, and there are motifs that are developed throughout that arise, return and veer off in different directions in all these surprising ways, I think.
Well, let's start with Reimer's Boots that I just absolutely love. It takes you to a very specific time and place, but basically it's the story of a guy from New England named Clarky, or would it be Clacky? Clacky, who was working on a converted tuna vessel that's docked in Oakland in 1968.
Really an unusual story in some ways because, as you intimated there, it's grounded in this time period. And so this is like the heady hippie days of all of that. Think of all the music that was coming at the same time because it's really a story in a number of ways about music. You have Hendrix doing his thing and Cream and Rolling Stones' Beggar's Banquet and Beatles' White Album. And this is kind of an American mecca this area in the West Coast where this story is taking place. And it's very much rooted in that historical quality. And you have to have like an immense historical knowledge and a musical knowledge to bring that off. But you also, so it's like you have one wheel spinning that way, but then you have this other wheel, like within the wheel, going the opposite direction. You know what I mean?
Mm.
It's going to, I don't want to say it's a fantasy, but it's this odd sort of thing that's unlike anything else where there is a magical quality to it with these particular tapes, these bootleg tapes of the title.
And yeah, Clarkey is working on a job for this guy named Reimer, unloading boats late at night. Nobody's really sure what it is, but as the story unravels, we get taken behind the curtain and we see what's going on, and we meet a fascinating cast of characters.
Yeah, it's quite an assembly in this group. And so I think what you're aiming to do is, people talk a lot about travel, for instance, and I believe that travel isn't about necessarily miles, but how well you're able to infuse yourself into a different place or state or mindset. So like someone would say to Thoreau, it's like, guy, you hardly ever leave like this 3 mile like radius. I mean, he would go to like Maine and write a book about that, or he'd go to Cape Cod, but it's not like Thoreau one day was thinking, I need to see Tucson, because he was so enamored of mastering everything that was around him in which he traveled. So for me, as a kind of corollary to that idea, is I can go places. Like, I'm there. I'm in the story. What you want to do is write from the inside out. But in order to do that, first you have to get inside. Once you're inside, then you just turn in all the directions, make a 360. It's like, oh, I see that, I see this, there's that character. And then those characters in that place, because characters also are rooted in their own character-y placeness, they're going to give you the story. They're going to reveal their personalities, their weirdness maybe, or their quirkiness, or their incongruities, or just what you expect them to say, but maybe they say it at like a different time when you wouldn't expect them to. So it's a story, I think, of a lot of surprises and a lot of freshness, and it has that historical foundation to it. But at the same time, though, we are conscious of the foundation. We're flying. We're flying through these ideas. We're flying through these different personalities, a kind of dark side mystery. There's like a noir vibe to this, like almost like a color noir, that whole like era after like the great 40s era of noir. There's just a lot happening with focus.
And we get to meet, at least in the periphery of the story, some of the music legends of that time and place.
Right, they're actually there. And so they're not the meat of the story, certainly, but there are going to be people or things, or it can be a bird or a kind of tree that's going to like sort of be in the background of a story, or something you walk by, or the character interacts with. And we had that earlier story, Eep and Abe, where Edgar Allan Poe and Abraham Lincoln are in the afterlife. And it's like this real paradigm shift with what we think we know about them. Now, I'm someone who always balks at the idea of like, I'm not like a historical fiction kind of person. That to me always feels like a cheat, where that's the primary thing. You're using these like historical figures as the way you think they were. When I wrote like Eep and Abe, I knew that Poe and Lincoln, I mean, they didn't even know each other. They weren't that way at all. It's a very different kind of ghost story. So like if Janis Joplin shows up in a story, it's going to maybe be consistent with who Janis Joplin was, but it's not really her story, except in how she's adding to what is there for these other characters, whose story it does belong to.
And there's a wonderful, one of many wonderful lines in this story, and it's something you've discussed with us before. A character says, "Do you have any prior experience as an artist?" That's a stupid question, though, isn't it? An artist is never in the past, not a true artist. There is no prior. There's just now and next.
Yeah, that's true. This story is from a long time ago. So it's like I haven't, to hear that line, I'm sort of like nodding along to it, like someone else wrote that. But that doesn't mean that an artist might not source a feeling from the past. But the reason they're mining that feeling, they're traveling, they're going inside that feeling and doing the 360, is because they're going to experience it differently and spin it out in a creative way that they haven't before, that's going to allow them to travel into the future, into a different sort of existence, narrative existence with other characters. It's like that idea in, and I didn't get this as a kid. I didn't get this until later, as much as I loved it. But it's that idea in A Christmas Carol, when Scrooge is cautioned, and he finally gets it himself, and he says it. And when he said it, I didn't understand it for a long time. That idea of living in the past, the present, and the future at once, that's deceptively simple the way Dickens renders it. But you really have to function that way in order to be moving forward. And so, like, sometimes we might talk about something I've written, and it would be, this is a sort of different take on this, but it could be from like 4 days ago or whatever it is, because we speak once a week. That'll be so far in the past for me, even though it's like living on and it's going to have its own life because of all the things written since then. That's what matters. It always just drives me insane. I couldn't do it. When these people are talking about things that they did so long ago and they haven't done anything since, that would kill me. But the idea that an artist is just, oh, this happened to me at a dinner party, and now here's like my story about it, or here's my painting. No, it doesn't work like that. That notion of present is so important. Like, do you remember that quote in The Last Dance when someone, I don't even know who it was, says about Michael Jordan, the reason he's so good, the reason he's better than everyone, is because he's always fully present in what he's doing when he's playing. And that is it. Like, when if I sit at the desk to write, I'm just like in a plane by myself, flying through the air, and nothing else exists. And I know that that's going to pay off for anything that I write. It's just going to come out that way because I'm there being me and I'm present.
Well, and what this story does, as so many of yours do, is it takes us on a journey to the past that ultimately leads us to take a deeper look inside and ask questions of ourselves about art and friendship and who we are as individuals and what we hope and strive to be.
Having a conversation with someone yesterday, actually, about the idea of the mirror. And I think a lot of times people, the standards and the expectations are so low. They don't go looking for things. And they end up being conditioned to works that, what's that, what Jewish people do when they sit Shiva, and there's like a blanket, or there's a towel right over the mirror, so they can grieve openly without having to see their image, right? They're not going to be self-conscious. And it's a little bit of a different thing, but I feel like so often the mirror is over everything out there, and that's not a way to live life. I would say to people who create work like that, and it's just so much, what are you doing? What is the point? That's just something I always ask myself, like with almost anything I do. What is the point? What are we trying to achieve here? What is the purpose? If you can't honestly answer that question in a way that facilitates your growth, and to me, more importantly, by far, the growth of others, there's really no point. I mean, even when I drink right now the hibiscus tea, sitting in my bathroom talking to you, why am I drinking the hibiscus tea? So I can keep going, so I can keep creating, so I can bring things to people's lives, and my health will be there for that. Everything to me is some form of, what is the point of what you're doing? So for my work, a big part of the point is the mirror, not to ram the mirror in your face, but to say, hey, take a look. It's really not so bad. We can do this together. It's a good story, too.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. Up next is Laying Sheets, and I can only describe this as, to me, a very ethereal setting as we meet the center of the story, a man who finds himself in a familiar spot and looking for the opportunity to be what he calls the speaker and to have an audience. And then we learn about a number of other people that inhabit this interesting world.
It's a transposition of someone who's had great loss. And when we have great loss, like we lose whatever we've lost in our life. It can be a person. It's often a person. But what do we lose along with that? And it's almost always this way. We lose control. Control is like one of those words where people think, that's so bad. But you do need control over aspects of your life. I mean, control isn't a bad thing. Over-control is, but like the control to know that, okay, I didn't have any drinks or I just had the one, I'm in control of the car type of thing. Control is important. And we also, when we lose like that, we usually lose our voice to some degree. These are some of the most human things that exist, and they're shorn from us or they're diminished. And so then we might find ways to try to cope or to manufacture the illusion of control. A lot of people do that. You see it all the time. And I think that's why people bury themselves in their own echo chambers, because that's an illusion of control. And trauma brings out a great need to find a way to get through, to even scheme with oneself to find a way to do that. So the story is about someone who's had a loss and inspired by experiences at a museum. And you go to these museums and they're like, not just the regular exhibits, but they're like these sort of interactive exhibits. And like, ooh, here is how we unearthed this archaeological site or that type of thing. And kids get into that. So it sort of riffs on that. And the protagonist creates this scenario, this invented inversion of reality, where he's taking characters that do exist, and people who have left him or hurt him. And he's fashioning this parallel world where he has a sort of like different say than he does like back in reality. And in a way, that's kind of how the Wizard of Oz functions. You have these two joint worlds. I mean, the reason that Dorothy ends up in Oz after she like sort of conks out is because things weren't going so well, or so she thought, back on the farm. So she was losing control, and it becomes this coping mechanism to wrest some of that back.
And the sheets of the title take on several different meanings in the tale.
They do. And so there's this idea of the sheets as in pages of a book. And a book has its own autonomy, if it's any good. Like a book sort of like rolls up its sleeves, spits in its palms and rubs them together and says, okay, big boy, I am pulling me out of you. That's what's going to happen. Until like you're sort of on friendly terms, and then like you want to do it, and you're Norman Cliff at the bar, and what should we do next? And let's do a book together, that kind of thing. Except it's just you talking to yourself and your book. But a book is going to arrive in the world if it has need to be in the world and can offer things by hook or by crook. And people have needs, and they use each other to satisfy those needs. A book is kind of the same way. So as this person is trying to invent their own like Private Idaho type of thing, to reference that film, the book is trying to get something, which is going to become a book, is trying to get something for itself as well. So in this actual book, there's a reason why this is coming near the end. Because it's not about me, but you are holding a book. And now it's going to bring up all those other things you've read and the journey that we've taken through those stories or chapters or whatever label doesn't yet exist to describe them.
He also has a very interesting theory about death. When someone died, they learned what really was, who you truly were, what you'd done wrong, hadn't done wrong, and what they'd been wrong about regarding what they thought you'd done wrong.
That's a great idea, that we can often bridge this impasse that exists between us and everyone. It really comes down to how much of that chasm we do get to span across. But no one ever knows us fully. And you think about, like, the percentages. The person in your life who knows you best, what percentage of you do they actually know? Like, does anyone ever really get above, like, 14%? Like, I don't know what the number is, the way we are, but it's not like it's 99.7. And then there are people who don't have information we want them to have, and they might think we're villainous when we're not. Mm. And you see this in families where there are these falling outs, and the bridge that might have existed over the chasm is pulled back, is even lesser than it was before. And someone might think, okay, well, when that person dies, then they'll get it. Then it will come to them. We put like this sort of strange emphasis on things that will happen when we die. For instance, have you ever noticed all the people who talk about like the Pink Floyd song or whatever it is that's going to be played at their funeral? Because they're thinking the same thing I'm kind of saying right now, except in the opposite direction. That as people sit there listening to time, everything will click, and they're going to get this person in a way they never did before. So here you have someone saying that out loud, but talking about the person who leaves, goes to the next world, as they stay behind. And there's like a modicum of, oh, my bad, I did that person wrong. I get it now. And it's sort of like a cold comfort or a subjunctive comfort in the here and now of our living world.
And finally, a magical tale called The Taste of Smoke, as we go to a coastal village, time undetermined, a place known as Living Dangerously, which I loved right away.
A place that stands outside of time, really, right?
Yes, oh yes.
5,000 years from now, but in a sense, you think, like, it's a very rustic and coastal and coastally rugged story of this sort of thrill town. I mean, that's sort of like the tourist industry, but it's exciting. It's, you know, I'm not a casino person, but it's like an ecological casino, like a thrill ride / amusement park. And there is someone who doesn't want to exist anymore and has created what they think is a plan. There's an irony here because they're not able to just succumb as a tourist might, and they want to go away again because of a loss. And last anything in a book, a novel, on an album, it means a lot. And that doesn't mean that the fourth chapter, fourth story doesn't mean a lot. It just means that they have different responsibilities in the book. You have to finish the final page and have this feeling of wishing to just sit there for a while, stand up, take a walk around the block. It has to wrap up the sensation of the totality. So this guy is going to build a kind of makeshift vessel and use all the detritus from the beach. And I mean, it's just like such a salty story in some ways, but also magical and futuristic and outside of the space-time continuum. And he is going to sail toward this plume of white smoke off on the horizon, which he thinks is going to be his deliverance. And it isn't that.
I love this line. In pain's perpetual high tide, nothing ever really means what it seems to mean.
That's true. It's time and tide waits for no man. Mm. And built into that expression is the tide comes in, the tide goes out. What's more regular than that? I mean, so long as the moon is hanging up where the moon hangs, the tide's going to do what the tide's going to do. But when we are mired in our pain, the tide never seems like it's going to go back out. If that tide is the pain in this analogy, it's always you walk down to the harbor and there's the water again, right up like about to crest over the top of the jetty every single time. And you can sit there and you can watch the moon, but it's that perpetual high tide. It's not actually that perpetual high tide, but that's how you're experiencing the world. And when you experience the world, something so fundamental, such a given in the world, as unmalleable, unchanging, of course, everything else is going to seem that way too. You're going to feel doomed. You're going to be bereft of hope. And this is a book for all of the lost in it, where it is true to that word in the subtitle. And it's the only outrightly positive word in the subtitle. I mean, one of the words is bad. I mean, it's like, quote-unquote, a bad word, but it also indicates people up to no good. And then another word can go either way. Fantasy, I mean, it can be, oh, you live in a fantasy world, or it can be healthy, productive, enriching, inspiring, and then fabulous is a kind of description, so it's passive. So you have this topography of the subtitle. That's why there's no and, because it would mess up the topography. But the one shining word of positivity is hope. And the reason why that is, and it's even evinced in this final story, is because that's the water of our emotional and mental state. I mean, we need the water for the physical state. You take away hope, the water of the emotional, the spiritual, all of that, the psychological, we're done. It's the thing that you have to have. It might be the only thing that you have to have, but you have to have it. And this is a story about someone journeying in a way and sort of ending up with it, maybe without meaning to or think that they could.
We all need that plume of smoke to go on, right?
Yes, and to knock out the kidney stones and to drink the cranberry juice and put the hair on the chest with the cranberry juice. You know what I'm talking about, Kimball.
I do, and I don't want to give it away, but there's a wonderful button from the buggy driver in the final line of The Taste of Smoke in the final line of the book.
Yeah, there's a character who shows up. It's pretty funny when he shows up because it's like the last thing you expect, right? Mm. Like when it happens, like it fits with the tone and the timbre of the story and everything. But it's sometimes you don't want to be too jump cutty. You want flow. Like, did you ever see that Buñuel film, Simone of the Desert?
No,
like,
no.
Sort of like cod Christ figure out in the desert, and he's all wise and weird and, like, mysterious and everything. And then, like, the last scene is the jump cut into the future, and he's like a beatnik in a coffee joint with jazz. And it's like this weird sort of surrealistic middle finger, but it's very incongruous at the end of that film. You want to maintain the flow, the consistency. And that doesn't mean that you're not turning left and you're not doing a hairpin turn right, but the road still has to be the road. And so this person who makes this entrance at the end on a road that could give out at any point, because that's the way this works and that's the way life works, makes for, I think, a great kicker to sort of cap everything off.
Well, we've talked about all the wonderful journeys in this book and a number of the great characters. If you haven't picked it up yet, what are you waiting for? Grab a copy of If You, brackets, Fabula, Fantasy, Effery, Hope by Colin Fleming. It's wonderful. By the way, loved your piece. The opening chapter will be in your book on horror movies that you posted on the blog about Curse of the Cat People.
Yes, the Val Luden film, which I'm sure we've talked about at some point or other. And another sort of, it's fitting, another film or another work that's hard to classify. And is it even a horror film? I think it definitely is. But I wanted to do another book in the sort of Scrooge vein, and I thought it was going to be 1931's Dracula. And then I was looking at this Orson Welles short film called Return to Gleneskull. And then over the weekend, I just kept coming back to The Curse of the Cat People. So I wrote the entire first chapter, as it will be in the book, pretty much. And it is up in full on the blog over at ColinFlemingLit.com.
Check it out. Thank you, Colin. We'll talk with you next week.
All right. Good luck with the Stones, sir.
Thank you, sir. It's Colin Fleming every Tuesday on Downtown.